next speaker is going to be Chris Crane. And Chris is a tremendous activist who many of you know, and he's been somewhat of a mentor to me almost over the last 2.5 years. From the time I started at Normal, he was gracious enough to let me pop my head into his office maybe like 36 times a day to ask so many questions. And even now that I've taken his position and he's up at SSDP just up Connecticut Avenue, he'll still come down to the office during lunch and help me get the conference database together and print these name tens. So I'd like to introduce Chris Crane. Chris started in marijuana activism with American University Normal and American SSDP in 1997. He graduated magna cum laude from American University in May 2000 with an honors degree in political science, culminating in an honors thesis entitled The War on Drugs, a Case Study in the Escalation of Failed Moral Policy. Chris worked as Normal's chapter coordinator and associate director for 6 years before moving to take the position of executive director at Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And Chris was recently named the June Freedom Fighter of the Month for High Times magazine. Congratulations, Chris.
All right, well, thanks for being here. It's really it's great to be at the Normal Conference. It's really strange to be here and not be behind the registration desk and actually get some time to talk to all you all here. Thanks for inviting me back to speak today. As Karen said, I've worked at Normal for the last 6 years, during which time I was heavily involved in organizing campus chapters, Normal's campus chapters, and it was the work with the campus activists that I always found to be sort of the most rewarding part of my job, and as difficult as it was to leave such a wonderful place up. So for the last few months, I've been the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. For those of you who don't know who we are, we're the largest grassroots student organization in the country working to find alternative policies to the war on drugs. And particularly, we try and involve students in the political process to change laws, in particular those laws that most negatively affect young people and students. Ever since I started in this issue back with American University and SSDP, I really believed in the importance of a strong student movement to end the war on drugs. I truly believe that no social movement has been or ever will be successful without a strong student component. And what the Normal chapters out there are doing and what SSDP chapters out there are doing provides that student backbone for the movement to end the war on drugs. Not only do the students sort of provide the backbone, and I very much think that the students are sort of the foot soldiers in the war to end the war on drugs. I also can't tell you in the last few years how many sort of veteran activists have come up to me at various Normal conferences and drug policy conferences and, you know, told me just how inspiring it is for them to see so many students here. For the students who come out to these things, they think that, you know, that it's, you know, for them it's really inspiring, and they think it's, you know, for a lot of kids it's like a dream come true. They're meeting their heroes of drug policy reform. You know, they get to hang out with Keith Straub and, you know, have a drink with Ethan Nadelman, or, you know, meet all these people that they've only sort of read about or that have inspired them to get involved in drug policy. And what I try and let the students know is that, you know, it's not just inspiring for for you guys to meet meet these sort of heroes of drug policy, but it's just as inspiring for activists who've been around for a long time to meet you guys. And I'm kind of right in between now. I've been doing this for about 10 years now, 7 years out of college, and it keeps me young and it keeps me going every time I get out, you know, and get to work with the students and see the energy and the enthusiasm and the optimism that students bring to this movement. And I think it's a much more vital role, I think, than most people realize, just in terms of the role that you guys play in keeping the rest of us going and keeping us inspired and keeping us from burning out, which is very easy to do in a movement where you have very few victories. So this panel, from what I understood, is sort of activism 101. So I want to sort of talk a little bit about basically why the student movement is so important, why it's incumbent on us as young people in this movement to get involved in changing laws, and then go into a little bit about some of the basics for some of the newer student activists, what you can do to help get your chapters up and running. And I'll be on another panel, I guess, tomorrow, where we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts of some of the policies that SSDP is working on and some of the campaigns for some of the more seasoned activists, student activists. But this is the basics, so this is a little bit more of a rah-rah type of speech and let you guys know why it's so important for us to have a strong student movement here. you know, I truly believe that this generation is going to be the generation that brings the drug war to its knees. You know, as I said, we are the... That's where it depends. As I said, we are the foot soldiers in the war on the war on drugs. Students have more time, students have more energy, students have more optimism than anybody else who works in this issue. And when the student movement, when the student groups get together with some of the existing groups to work on campaigns in their local communities, it's amazing what can be accomplished. And I'm going to get into that a little bit. But one of the reasons I think it's so important, and one of the reasons I think that we're going to win this fight, that our generation is going to be the generation to win this fight, is because of the DARE program. I mean it. I mean, how many people in this room have gone through the DARE program? All right. I mean, I think that's a great testimony to how well the program works. Yeah. And in all honesty, and, you know, all joking aside, the DARE program is a program that lies to kids. They lie to you at a very young age. They tell you that, you know, marijuana is going to make you stupid. Marijuana is going to make you a bad person. That if your parents are smoking marijuana, you got to turn them into the police. You know, they tell you all of these things that, you know, marijuana is going to do all these horrible, crazy things to you. And then for just about everybody, there's a moment of realization. And for a lot of people, that moment of realization is, you know, they see their friends smoke a joint and they, you know, kick their ass in basketball. And they think, wait a minute, this isn't a lazy stoner on the couch. Like, everything they told me is a lie. It's all bullshit. And I think that moment of realization, that moment that I've been lied to, is really motivating. You know, I'll give you guys sort of my story on that, and it's a little bit more intense, I would say, than most. I think most people's, you know, sort of moment of realization is that, you know, their friend smokes a joint and beats them in basketball kind of moment. But, you know, for me, it was, I was when I was a really little kid, when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I basically watched my father die of a very rare form of emphysema. And as he was dying, he smoked marijuana. He said it helped open up his bronchial passages. I didn't understand what he was talking about at the time. I just knew, you know, daddy's going to smoke a joint. You know, go in the bedroom and watch Sesame Street. And, okay. And dad would roll up these little cigarettes. And my father passed away when I was about 8 years old. And it was when I was probably, I don't know, 14 or 15 or something like that. I mean, 14 years old. And, you know, a friend of mine asked me if I want to smoke. Somebody asked me if I want to smoke a joint. And I started thinking, wait a second. Joints? Marijuana? That's that stuff that the DARE program's been telling me is so bad for me? That's, you know, that's the stuff that's supposed to kill you? I was like, that's the stuff that made dad feel better. You know, that's what helped dad breathe, you know, when he was dying. And it was that sort of moment of realization that, wow, this is all just a crock of lies. And, you know, being lied to, I think, is the most motivating factor out there to get involved. And because our generation had to sit through the DARE program and listen to all the lies that they told us, we're going to be the generation that is motivated enough to end this war on drugs. If for no other reason, for spite. I think spite's a pretty good reason. You know, we talk about our generation, and we at SSDP, we like to call them the DARE generation. We are the DARE generation. You know, most of you in this room remember the Nancy Reagan Just Say No campaigns. The, you know, all those smiling little kids and Just Say No t-shirts standing in front of the Capitol, you know, all the little kids screaming, Just Say No, you know, repeated. Yeah, that was us. We were those smiling little kids in front of the Capitol. You know, we were those smiling little kids in the DARE programs repeating what we were told. Just say no, marijuana's bad. It's like the South Park episode. You know, drugs are bad, okay? You know, you repeat what you hear. And, you know, we all grew up and we realized it was a crock of lies. And that, you know, for me, that really pissed me off. And I think for all the students in this room and all the young people in this room, that's really motivating. And so we are the DARE generation, and we are the generation that is going to end the war on drugs. And I, you know, I talked a little bit about the motivating factors, but we're also going to do it because we are the most affected by the war on drugs. You know, if you take a look at a report that Normal put out last year, which looked at the arrest data around this country, and you look at who's arrested for marijuana possession in this country, the majority of people arrested are under 25 years old. It's young people. The war on drugs is a war on youth. It's a war on young people. And it's a war that's been waged in our names. It was waged in our names to protect us as kids when we were those smiling kids in front of the capitals and in front of the Capitol. And it's waged in our name today because we are the ones being arrested. And there's no greater example of this, no more egregious policy, egregious example of the war on drugs being a war on youth than the Higher Education Act 8 elimination penalty. This is a law that was signed into provision that was signed into law in 1998 by Bill Clinton that automatically denies federal financial aid to any student with a drug conviction. And to date, according to the latest numbers by the Department of Education, 190,000 students since the year 2000 have been denied financial aid as a result of a drug conviction. We at SSDP, we just won a lawsuit where we had actually filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Education seeking a simple state-by-state breakdown of how many students have been denied aid due to a drug conviction. And the Department of Education got back to us, being a 501c3 and C4 nonprofit organization exempt from any fees associated with Freedom of Information Act requests. And the Department of Education got back to us and said, no, you know, you need to pay $4,100 for this information, administrative fees, because it's really a commercial interest. Because if we give you this data, it could lead to drug legalization, and SSDP could profit from that legalization. Therefore, you have to pay $4,100 in administrative fees. So we sued them. And really what they were doing with that was they were just trying to silence us. They didn't like what we were going to do with the data. So we sued the Department of Education, and within 30 days, they gave in. And we won. And they said, we'll waive all the fees. We'll give you all the data within 2 weeks. And they did. And we just put together a report. So now if anyone's interested in finding out how many students have been affected by this law, we've got reports on our table, the SSDP table. We're kind of in a little alcove over there. In their own state. Not just how many students have been denied aid, but how many students in every state. And the greatest thing, or the irony of ironies in this report, is that the national average for students being denied financial aid was about 1 in 800 students who apply for aid or denied aid because of a drug conviction. It's 0.25% of all applicants. The state with the highest percentage, with double the national average at 0.5%, was Indiana. That's right. The reason that's so ironic is that Indiana is the home state of Representative Mark Sauter, who is the author of the HEA aid elimination penalty and the chief proponent of the law in Congress, and it's his constituents that are being denied financial aid at twice the rate of students all across the country. We've gotten a great deal of press about this. The press in his local district, you know, just ate it up. The Indianapolis Star even wrote an editorial on our behalf, on behalf of our report. So if you're interested in checking out some of this data, come pick up a copy of the report at the SSDP table here. Also on this front, the HEA provision was actually scaled back after about 8 years of lobbying and hard work by Students for Sensible Drug Policy and our coalition partners in the Coalition for Higher Education Act reform. We were able to scale back the Higher Education Act aid elimination penalty so that it no longer applies retroactively. It now only applies to students who are receiving aid at the time of their conviction. So if you have, if you were busted for possession at 18 years old and you decide to go back to school at 22, you're not going to be denied aid on the basis of that conviction. So because of this change in the law, tens of thousands of students likely are now going to be able to go back to school who would have been denied financial aid before this change. So we felt this was a tremendous victory. It's going to help, you know, thousands of students around the country. And hey, victories in the war on drugs in Congress are few and far between. We're really proud of that, although we feel it's a 10% solution to a law that's 100% flawed. So what we're doing now is we just sued the government again. In fact, we sued the Department of Education again with the help of the ACLU Drug Law Reform Project. They're handling the case pro bono for us. The case is called SSDP v. Spellings for Margaret Spellings, who's the Secretary of Education. And we filed suit in federal district court in South Dakota, challenging the constitutionality of the Higher Education Act aid elimination penalty. And if we're successful, no student will ever again have to worry about losing their financial aid because of a simple drug conviction, be it before they went to college or during college. But let's move a little bit to the campus level here, because that's really what this is all about. It's not necessarily what we're doing at the national level. You know, as proud as I am of the work that we've accomplished at the national level, the real work is what the students are doing. We would not have gotten that law scaled back were it not for thousands of student activists all across the country working on their campuses to repeal this law. We would not have had the law repealed had about 150 student governments nationwide not passed resolutions calling on Congress to repeal the law. that was sort of where the grassroots really help us at the national level change policy. We've had normal chapters and SSCP chapters all across the country working to get their student governments to pass resolutions calling on Congress to repeal this terrible law. You know, also at the campus level, there's been so many achievements in the past few years. Just today, actually, we got word that yesterday the Truman State chapter passed got a resolution, actually an initiative passed that bans the school from notifying students' parents if they're busted for drug possession on campus. So these students now don't have to worry about, you know, facing the wrath of their parents in addition to their university penalties. So that was a victory we just heard about. We've had students attend summits put on by the Office of National Drug Control Policy all over the country. The ONDCP has been putting on these summits to basically teach school administrators and school board members why they should drug test their kids. And so we've been organizing SSDP chapters and normal chapters all over the country to show up and talk to these educators and talk to these administrators and tell them why we think this is a really bad idea, why we think that student drug testing is counterproductive and ineffective. And it's been an incredibly effective use of campus activist time to go to these summits and convince these educators. And the response has been terrific. Most of these people that show up at these ONDCP summits show up because they want to know if they should drug test their students. They're not there to find out how to do it. And we've had tons of people come up to us and tell us how appreciative they are of the fact that there are students out there talking to them, telling them why they feel that this is an ineffective policy, not talking necessarily about marijuana prohibition, not talking about the bigger issues, but just talking to these educators as, you know, students who are just out of high school themselves, why they think that student drug testing is a bad idea. We've seen student chapters across the country passing initiatives that so-called safer initiatives that ask the administration to treat marijuana offenses similar to alcohol offenses, which on most campuses, underage drinking is just as illegal as marijuana possession. And yet on most campuses, if you get caught for underage drinking on campus or in the dorms, you get 10 hours community service or 20 hours community service. You get caught smoking marijuana in the dorms, you get kicked out of the dorms. Oftentimes they call in the local police. You get an arrest record, you lose your financial aid. So the penalties are so much harsher than what they're trying to control. And so just in the past month, Florida State University and the University of Maryland, both schools that have very active normal and SSDP chapters, passed these safer initiatives on campuses, both with over 60% margin. University of Colorado and Colorado State did them as well. We've actually incorporated this safer campaign into a campaign that we have at SSDP called the Campus Change Campaign. Very briefly, basically what that campaign is we ask students to try and identify what's the worst drug policy on campus, and then we give them ways that they can go about changing it. And we've actually got a document on the campaign that you can get at our table as well, at the SSDP table over there. If you're interested in finding out more about the Campus Change Campaign, that's actually what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow at the Effective Grassroots Activism panel. So I certainly encourage those of you who are interested in hearing about policies being changed on campus to come to that panel tomorrow, and I'll be going through how we do this campaign. And we've also had campus chapters involved in establishing drug resource centers on campus. Chapters have actually changed local laws in Columbia, Missouri. They passed two initiatives, one to protect medical marijuana patients and one to make marijuana enforcement the lowest law enforcement priority. And those were basically run by SSDP Normal and ACLU campus activists. Campus activists are achieving a lot of change, both at the campus level, at the national level, and at the local level. And we really are the backbone of this movement. But before you guys get there, and this is sort of the grassroots 101 stuff, you got to start. You got to start somewhere. You're not going to jump into this and just change the laws on campus right away. You got to start. You got to build a movement on campus. You have to build an organization on campus. And so to do that, I always encourage new chapters to start out with a project that you can get results, but that costs very little money, because as a campus group, you're generally not going to get funded in your first year. So you need to find something that you can do that you can show tangible results, but that's not going to cost a whole lot of money. And the best thing to do that we found is to try and get your student government to pass an HEA resolution. Try and get them to pass a resolution to call on Congress to repeal the law. If your school's already passed one, you can get them to try and pass a safer resolution or any resolution. It really doesn't matter. It's what you do in that campaign that really counts. So you table on campus for a couple of weeks, and you collect signatures from students who want to see the student government pass this resolution. You collect their name, their signature, and their email address. and you take all those email addresses after you've collected them for 2 weeks or so tabling on campus, and you put them in a Yahoo group or an email list or something, so that now all of these students who sign your petition are going to find out about what you guys are doing on campus. And if you're holding an event, they're going to know about it. They may not become core members. They may not show up to all of your meetings, but they'll come if you hold an event on campus, a speaker or a festival or something like that. These people will come. You now have them on your email list. You've now got a campaign. So when you're lobbying, when you take these petitions to your student government and you tell them, we want you to pass this resolution, look, 3,000 students have signed this petition and support this, you back it up with letters to the editor of your student newspaper. You get your name out there. You make people on campus know who you are. And then when your resolution passes, you work with members of the student paper and get them to write articles about it. So you can actually get something accomplished here. You can get a resolution passed. And in the meantime, it's a terrific way to grow your organization in the process. And it really doesn't cost very much money. And once you've done that, once you've got students showing up to your meetings, you identify new core members, be very cautious not to allow your club to become a sort of a social group for a pre-existing group of friends. Be very welcoming with open arms to any new members who show up to a meeting. Give them responsibility. Give them a committee chairmanship. Give them an assignment, a task. You know, make them feel invested in the group. And you'll find a lot of new blood coming into your organization, and a lot of new leaders who, you know, you didn't know, who weren't part of your pre-existing group of friends, will come and will end up becoming very important core members of your organization. So something like this, something as simple as getting your student government to pass a resolution, is a terrific way for you to grow your organization, build your membership list, bring in new core members, and once you've done that, you're then ready to go on to do a campus change type campaign or some of these bigger events, and perhaps even go into the local communities and change laws within your communities. Finally here, I want to encourage those of you who are out there. I know there are both normal chapters here, there are SSTP chapters here. Where we've seen some of the greatest success has been on campuses that have both normal and Students for Sensible Drug Policy chapters. And I think there's a few reasons for that. Number one, it sort of allows you to wear different hats. If you're working on marijuana policy, if you're working on something marijuana specific, you do it under the guise of normal. If you want to, you know, be really out there and use the marijuana leaf and, you know, use some of the cool cultural imagery and get students to show up, you can do it under the guise of normal. If you want to work on an HEA resolution, get your student government to, you know, lobby your student government to get them to pass some sort of resolution, sometimes it's better to do that as SSTP. If you want to get into, you know, prisons, issues like, you know, schools not prisons, that falls a little bit more within the scope of SSTP. So it allows you to sort of wear different hats and work on different issues. But more importantly, it allows you to double dip. That's the key. as long as you have two executive councils, if you've got enough people that you can split up your executive board, your president, vice president, and so forth, and you apply to the university to form, if you've got a normal chapter, you apply to form an SSTP chapter, vice versa, and you have both chapters, you can hold meetings together, you can coordinate a lot of events together, you can do a lot of work together, but you'll get twice the funding from the university. It's a natural partnership. We've seen, like I said, Florida State and University of Maryland that just passed these initiatives both had very strong normal and SSTP chapters. We've seen great things, so I certainly encourage those of you who have chapters who are large enough to start both to do so. I think it'll benefit you. And again, I just want to reiterate, you know, we are the DARE generation, and we are the generation that's going to end this war on drugs. And I'm honored, and it warms my heart to be able to be up here and to help lead this generation to end this horrible war on drugs, and finally put an end to all this nonsense in the name of all the young people and all the students out there. So thanks for having me back here this year.
And thanks for coming back, Chris. Anytime. So. In the interest of time, and being as where we got the panel that was at 4:20 on 4:20, we may skip the question and answer session or maybe shorten it at the end because I want to give Lauren plenty of time to speak. And we had a great panel today of six amazing activists, but I was particularly thrilled to have three incredible women activists. And to introduce our third is Lauren Vasquez. And if you're from California, you know Lauren's name. She's wonderful. She has done some amazing things at her school, University of California, Santa Barbara. And I'm going to let her tell you a little bit more about that, but in ways of an introduction. Excuse me, Lauren. She is 23, from Camarillo, California, recently graduated from UCSB, where she earned her bachelor's degree in both communication and law and society. While at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Lauren successfully restarted the Normal Chapter, which has become one of the most active organizations on campus, as well as one of the most active Normal Chapters. And let's see. Through Normal, she met Dr. David Behrman, many of you know, and currently works as his office assistant. Recently, their office helped Patients Out of Time coordinate the 4th National Cannabis Clinic Therapeutics Conference. She also serves on the Sensible Santa Barbara Committee, which has introduced the SB Lowest Police Priority Ordinance for Adult Use of Marijuana. Lauren is also going to law school in the fall, and in the future, she hopes to work with ACLU Drug Policy Reform Project. Please welcome Lauren Vasquez.
Hello, everybody. Happy 420. I'm very pleased to be here. This is a great way to celebrate the holiday. I'd just like to thank Normal for inviting me to be here and thank the other panelists. It's an honor to be on the panel with you folks. You've been doing this longer than I've even known about the issue, and some of you longer than I've been alive. So it's quite an honor. As Karen said, I came to the University of California, Santa Barbara, and I restarted the chapter there. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my experience because that's pretty much all I know. I learned from my mistakes, and I hope to share that information with you folks. I transferred to the University of California, Santa Barbara, and I was disappointed about that because, of course, I wanted to go to Berkeley and become a punk-headed activist up there and just change the world, but they didn't want me. So I figured it was okay because UC Santa Barbara had a Normal chapter, and that'd be a really great way for me to get involved because I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in marijuana reform. I wanted to end the drug war. I wanted to legalize all drugs and make the world a better place. So when I came to UC Santa Barbara, I was very disappointed to find out that the campus chapter was not active. They hadn't been active in several years. So I just couldn't let that stand. I had to do something about that. And it took a little while. I got in touch with the former leaders of the chapter, and many people had graduated. That's why our chapter died off. And so I started pretty much with just two people, and they were busy with school. So I went out, and I set up a table on campus with a big sign said Normal with the pot leaf. And I sat out in the sunshine of Santa Barbara, and I just collected emails, and once I had enough emails on my list, I started having meetings, and many of the people who came to our first meeting 2 years ago are still members now, and they're here at this conference with us, and they've helped me do a lot. I started with no experience. I'd never done anything like this before. I was just a regular stoner from suburbia, and I knew I wanted to do something, but I had no idea how to do it, and I knew I needed help. So once I started having meetings, I really was lost. I had all these people in the room, and I didn't know how to get them to do what I wanted them to do. And that was part of the problem. It wasn't really about what I wanted to do. It was what about the group wanted to do and what the group felt needed to get done. So I really reached out to all the campus resources to get help since I didn't know what I was doing. And I was fortunate to enroll in a leadership certificate program on campus that required me to take a leadership 101 class, and I learned a lot from that, and I'll share some of that with you in just a minute. But first, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about our chapter and how we function. Our mission is simply just to educate the public about cannabis and why cannabis laws need to be reformed. And we do that by having fun events on campus just to bring the community out and get their attention and maybe try to impart a little bit of knowledge to them so that when bills are introduced, they can tell their senators or their congresspeople to vote for them, or they themselves can vote yes on our initiatives. And so it's important to decide what message you want to get across. We have lots of chapters using the safer message. Cannabis is safer than alcohol. That's a great message. In Santa Barbara, we're really blessed. There's really no opposition. It might make things sound easy. Sometimes it's hard to get attention. But as Chris was explaining, with the HEA resolutions, I didn't have to gather 3,000 signatures. I just went to the Office of Student Life and found out where I was supposed to go to get something like that introduced, and somebody did it for me. One of the Associated Students members said, oh, I'll introduce that at the Ledge Council meeting and get it passed. And a week later, I had passed an AS resolution saying UC Santa Barbara supported ending the higher education provision, which denied financial aid. And so it was so easy to just get something done right away. It didn't take a lot of work. So once I did get a group of people together, it was really easy to get things done. But there's some challenges with leading a campus chapter, and those challenges start with credibility. You know, everybody expects us to be the stoner slacker group on campus, and sometimes we do have stoner slackers, but you know what? We're also students. First off, that gives us credibility right away. We had to earn that right to be on that campus, and so, you know, we do have abilities, and we're not just losers on the street. We have a little bit of credibility to start off with, which really helps us a lot. But unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't work. So the way we gain credibility is just by going out there and getting things done. And like I said, we passed the AS resolution right away, but we also just tabled out there every day, and anytime there was a campus event being hosted, we participated in that, the campus activities fair, the leadership retreat. We were invited to come to UC Merced for their first week of school to table and maybe get a new chapter started there, which we did, and we did get a new chapter started. And the administration sees you, your fellow students see you, the associated students, leaders see you, and they see what you're doing and that you're getting things done, and that's what gives you credibility and respect. And once you start to build it, it just snowballs and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as Karen said, our chapter is now one of the largest chapters or campus organizations, and we have a lot of respect. And even with that respect, we still get problems. So I can imagine what it's like for people at other chapters. But just go out there and get things done, and that's what gives you credibility. And you can wear a suit and a tie if you want, but pink hair is all right, too. Yeah. Another challenge with campus chapters is just time. At UCSB, we're on the quarter system. It's a 10-week system. That means every 3 or 4 weeks, we have a midterm, and then 4 weeks later, we have a final, and then everybody leaves for a week, and then they come back and do it all over again. So when do we get stuff done in between then? It's really a challenge. You got to make sure you stay on top of things. And the key to that is just really delegating, using your group members, using the resources that you have. Another challenge is motivation. A lot of people join chapter or campus organizations so that they can put something down on their resume, so that they can get credit on a grad school application for that extracurricular activity. But normal is like a red flag, so people think, no, I don't want to do that. So really, the people who do show up want to be there for a reason. They're there because they want to affect change and they want to get things done. So you have to use that motivation. You have to give them an opportunity to participate and give back. And so also with motivation, people think, once again, we're lazy stoners, but we're really not. Sometimes cannabis can be very motivating in the opposite way when you think of the way things can be, and if you just take small steps, someday we can be free, and cannabis can really motivate you in a lot of ways. So, and finally, at the campus chapters, we have huge turnover, graduation. People are leaving every year, coming and going. Leaders are graduating. So it's important that every person in the organization is involved in leadership. It should not just be one or two people leading the group. It really needs to be coming from everybody within the group. And you need to communicate with your members. You need to have accountability with your members. When they say they're going to do something, make sure it gets done. You know, it goes along with credibility. Are we going to be slackers? Are we going to get things done? And also, keep it simple. You know, like the other panelists have said, you don't have to do a huge rally right away. You can just go get a simple resolution passed through your government. You can just start passing out flyers that talk about the Higher Education Act, because students are really affected by this issue. One of the keys that really helped me in leading my campus chapter was just lessons from grassroots leadership. And in grassroots leadership, the goal is really to develop leadership in others, which fits perfectly with the campus needs of always having to develop new leadership because people are graduating. So grassroots leadership requires very little position power for leaders, which also fits well with normal campus chapters because leaders have little ability to reward and punish their members. If they don't get things done, how can you punish somebody? So again, the motivation that people want to get things done, you have to really use that and let people know that they're participating and they're getting things done. And this also leaves the entire group accountable. So if things go wrong, it's not one person's fault. And when things go right, it's not one person's credit. It's everybody's credit and everybody's gain. So that everybody works together so that it's a success and not one person is stressing out saying, oh, my God, if I don't get this one speaker to show up, everybody's going to think I'm a fool because I told them they would come. You know, it falls back on the group. And with students, we are busy. Chris said we have time. I don't know where that came from. We're very busy with tests in school and extracurricular activities, and if you have to have a job on top of that, it doesn't leave a lot of room for something like this. So you have to really use your strengths and your members. Don't have somebody who's shy out there tabling, you know. Get the motivated, energetic person out there tabling. You don't have to force somebody into something that doesn't work for them. But also when it comes to leadership, the leaders are there really to facilitate the group rather than to direct. Just help people get things done. If they want to get things done, help them. Make sure there's a room to meet at. Make sure there's a sign-up sheet so you can get people's emails. Make sure somebody puts those emails in a list so that we can email everybody and let them know where the meeting is next time. Sometimes simple things like that seem really easy, but they're actually pretty hard to get done. So one example that I would just like to share with you is our new co-chair, Alex. He came to our group this year, and he was a freshman and didn't even know about normal. And within a couple of weeks, we'd given him a position on our board as a publicity chair, and now he's going to be a co-chair for next year. And we didn't require anything of him but his service, and he came and he put up and he showed up, and he really helped the group succeed, and it's because we gave him the opportunity to do what he wanted to do and what he was able to do, and we're really going to succeed because of that. And so the message is, as leaders of these types of chapters, these types of organizations, the key is really to give up control, and that was really hard for me. It's my chapter. I started it. I'm doing all the work. Why can't we do what I want to do? Well, people don't want to help me do what I want to do. They want to do what they want to do. So I had to ask, what does the group want to do? How do you guys want to run the chapter? What are your goals for the group? And yes, setting goals is very important, but make sure you share those goals with the group, because if you leave, because you will, you'll graduate and move on, the group will retain those goals and retain the leadership and retain all the skills that they've gained and continue to go on and evolve and hopefully never stop and keep getting it done until it's done. And that's about it, unless you have a question.
Yes, okay. You said you started a group?
Sort of, okay. Yes.
Okay, I've worked with student groups for ages and maybe it's because people know I'm not a student that nobody shows up at the meetings.
Yeah.
And this one person talked to the DC office, said she wanted to start the group. Signs all the documents and stuff, the problem she has. She goes to school full time and at least works at least 3 nights a week until 10 o'clock. So
yeah.
She has anything to do. So this office I've worked out of 12 years since last Thursday said that they would help her. The problem is she doesn't want it. So what do you do with something like that?
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. As a student, we have a lot of responsibilities. Yeah, no, for her, though, it's hard. It really is. You have to give and take.
Because
you're not a student there, exactly. Well, start a community chapter. Start a community chapter. Or also, you know, you can – I don't know about what campus chapter you're close to. We're a public university. See, we're a public university. Anybody can table on our campus at any time. So
it's ran by the state.
Yeah. But that's a possibility for you to just go out and table. And
I do it all the time.
They might have a little prejudice against your age.
I have 800
Yeah.
Like 800 or 900 signatures, and we only got 3 people at meetings.
Yeah.
So I understand that you have to put up flyers.
Yeah.
This person doesn't have time.
Well, that's a good point. Also, you have to work with what you have available for you. Maybe having meetings and lots of members won't work for you. Maybe you can do something with 1 or 2 people like Norma does in Oklahoma. For us, we have a lot of support. We're able to get a lot of members. But you can change your focus and change your mission and change your goals to just suit what resources you have, what options you have. You know, try new things. Yeah. Try new things. Yeah. Well, Karen's in charge, though. Do you want to moderate?
Huh?
Do you want to moderate the question and answers? Oh, okay, sure.
how big is your college chapter?
Our campus chapter, we have 65 dues-paying members, and about 30 people come to the meetings every Wednesday. We meet once a week on Wednesdays. Meetings are important. They build fellowship, definitely. Communication as well between the group. I hope what I said made sense earlier. It all happened so fast. Yeah, sure.
Yes, I was. No, I wasn't. No, this was like in 1972, and I was, I don't know, and what happened. Marijuana, I mean, I always smoked bud, I mean, since, yeah. Yeah, I was out of the closet. Yeah. Well, I didn't feel I had to please everybody. As long as I had a majority of the vote, I could do what I wanted. Yeah. Well, I didn't run as a marijuana candidate at all. It was a side issue. I mean, everybody did. It was kind of a plus. It gave it endeared me, you know, to what it turned out. I won in a three-way race. So I won with 37% of the vote. That's how I got in. So the marijuana thing, you know, and we would smoke like right at student government meetings and stuff like that. Yeah. Detroit. Yeah. 997. Yeah. Well, the school, it was it had like maybe 10,000 students, and it was like 997 of them, you know, voted is what it was. It was a campus-wide one. Yeah. But there was no runoff thing. That's why I was lucky, because I would have lost otherwise. Thank you. Well, no, I just want to say, you know, stick with it. I think if any of you are interested in, you know, in terms of making money and the idea of being involved in this kind of politics, this is pretty rough stuff. And if you go into, like, business areas and things like that, I mean, this is a good education, believe me. It's a hard business, changing the public opinion and changing laws. It's... You know, they want to just keep it the same, you know, and that, but you can't beat them, but you got to be very focused. You got to really, you know what you want and set a goal and just do it and just, and then people get excited. You create a sense of excitement about it, and then people see it can be done. We won 4 initiatives now, you know, in Michigan, Detroit, Ferndale, Traverse City, Ann Arbor, and by big margins, all in 60%, and we're doing another one in Flint. Medical, and we're doing one of lowest law enforcement priority in the city of Niles. We got a guy, he's been a 20-year veteran in the U.S. Army, staff sergeant, retired, Bronze Star, and he's leading this in Niles, in the city of Niles. So, you know, and he got busted, and he's very angry about it, and, you know, he told his probation people, that hey, you know, he's pissed, and I said, well, listen, why don't you just change the law? Oh, I'm going to do that. So that's what he's doing. And we're trying to create that kind of excitement in Michigan, and there's people coming out of the woodwork now because they see that we're, you know, doing something and that it can be done. That this propaganda is just, you know, a lot of it's hocus pocus. So yeah.
So did you do your hash pasta share?
Yep. Yeah, we did. We did. That's another thing we got going. That and we got a bill. We got a bill in the legislature because of the result of the wins that we had in those last elections. So, and we welcome, you know, anybody. And we try to just keep it open. You know, there's politics that get involved. There's infighting that goes on, and especially if you're doing something. So you got to be able to, you know, deal with that too. And it's not easy. You know, it's kind of neat thinking you're, you know, having some title and all that, but it's not about that. It's hard work. It really is, but it's well worth it.
No, I put it in my folder as a souvenir, yeah. But what are your I'm originally from Boise, Idaho, so I began being in a red state trying to make this argument with people. What are some of the techniques that you found best in talking to the, you know, the very conservative down-home rancher farmer type who, you know, when you're trying to make this argument to them, especially, you know, speaking to the morality aspect, how they see it as being immoral? What works for you in Oklahoma?
You know, actually, I did not know how close this issue is to conservatism. I read the Republican platform, and I said, by God, this is a conservative issue.
Yeah.
And so you pitch it that way and show them how much money that we can save, and they got to hear it, and they do. They actually embrace it when you put it in economical terms.